Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Inner Man Show. I'm your host, Dylan Eckes. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest to discuss a variety of important topics, topics that, in my opinion, every specifically father should be having conversations about. And before I introduce him, I just want to say that this particular individual, his book single-handedly changed my perspective on fatherhood, being a parent, and being a member of my community. So today I'm speaking with the one and only Dr. Warren Farrell. Dr. Farrell has been chosen by the Financial Times as one of the world's top 100 thought leaders. His books are published in over 50 different countries in 19 languages. They include the New York Times bestseller, Why Men Are the Way They Are, plus the international bestseller, The Myth of Male Power. His most recent book, The Boy Crisis, co-authored with John Gray in 2018, was chosen as a finalist and for the Forward Indies Award, which is the Independent Publishers Award. Dr. Farrell has been a pioneer in both the women's movement. He was elected three times to the board of the NOW in New York City, and in the men's movement. He was called by GQ magazine the Martin Luther King of the men's movement. He conducts couples communication workshops nationwide. He's appeared on over 1,000 TV shows, been interviewed by Oprah, Barbara Walters, Peter Jennings, Katie Couric, Larry King, Tucker Carlson, Regis Philbin, Charlie Rose, and most recently, Dr. Jordan Peterson. He has frequently written for and been featured in the New York Times and the publications worldwide. Dr. Farrell has two daughters, lives with his wife in Mill Valley, California, and can be found virtually at www.warrenfarrell.com. Dr. Farrell, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to our little podcast and to our audience of our nonprofit organization.
Well, your dedication inspired me, and so I'm looking forward to our talking.
Thank you so much. So I know you don't have much time, so we'll get right into it here. Your book, The Boy Crisis, like I said, completely changed my perspective and outlook on fatherhood, and mainly among myself, because I have three boys, right? One of the main areas of focus in your book in The Boy Crisis is dad deprivation. In our particular area in Canada and many other rural small town environments, we see a lot of men giving up their father time to make more money or advance their careers, specifically in oil and gas and in the energy sector. A lot of men say they will do it to provide an income for their families. However, Dr. Farrell, with your book and The Boy Crisis and the research on the topic, we now know in 2022 that this is severely detrimental to the development of our children. Why do you think this isn't being discussed amongst mainstream society? Why aren't men being informed of this from their employers, health officials, when it comes to the development of our children?
Well, historically, we've always sort of relied on men as the provider, protector. And we really, and when we were in survival mode in all the undeveloped countries or partially developed countries, survival meant you had to have that basic income. And so you didn't focus on men as father because that would have kept them in the home and away from the income that they needed to create in order to survive. But we found that as once a family has about 50 to 70,000 US dollars per family, depending on where in Canada or the United States they live, somewhere in that range where survival is maintainable, a dad's time becomes more important than a dad's dime in terms of the successful mental health of the children being raised. And while that's true of both girl and boy children, it's particularly true of boy children. And so I began to start seeing the connection here. Some before I started the research for The Boy Crisis, I had looked at, I looked at all 56 of the largest developed nations, and in the developed nations, and note the word developed, in those 56 developed nations, boys were falling significantly behind girls in every single academic subject, including especially in reading and writing. And reading and writing were the single biggest predictors of children doing well or poorly. And so I started asking myself, well, why developed nations? What was this common denominator? And I saw that in developed nations, there was much more permission, you know, to survival in the middle and upper middle class was partially or well taken care of, depending on the family. And when that was happening in a culture, that society started becoming less strict about its rules of the importance of mothers and fathers being married and the importance of them, if they were married, not getting a divorce. And so there was much more permission for divorce and much more permission for children to be raised by one parent only, usually the mom. And so in those cases, I started to see that that's where the boys were falling behind the girls. And so, but when I submitted the boy crisis to my publisher, I had identified 10 causes of the boy crisis. And so I planned to make about equal sections on all 10 of the causes. But the more I started doing the research, the more I saw that was not exactly a good analysis. So for example, if a boy in particular was raised in a home with an involved mother and an involved father, and the boy went to a school that had 90% or 100% female teachers, the boy didn't usually experience much of a problem. But if the boy grew up in a mom-only home and went from a female-only home to a female-only or almost female-only school, the boy became very vulnerable to not having a male role model in his life and seeing what a productive, successful male that was a good role model was able to help him. And so he became much more vulnerable to joining a gang, because the gang was sort of a substitute family, or being seduced into selling. He usually wasn't very productive in school, wasn't very successful, and therefore sort of felt ashamed of himself. And maybe his first job was really, a minimum wage or less than minimum wage job. And so he was especially able to be seduced by a drug dealer to say, hey, you can get 5 times that much money, and you can get a car, you can drive around, the girls will be interested in you, they won't think you're a loser. And so they were much more seduced by that. And as I began looking at this historically, I saw that Hitler Youth had the same exact phenomenon. They focused on seducing, if you will, young males who were dad deprived. And so I started to see the importance of dad deprivation. And that got me to investigate a lot of things that were happening with boys. So for example, I saw that boys were far more likely than girls to commit suicide once they were over the age of 9. So for example, 9-year-old boys and girls are only very, very rarely commit suicide if they're under 9 or 9. And when they do, they committed suicide about equally. But boys between the ages of 10 and 14 committed suicide twice as often as girls between the ages of 10 and 14. Between the ages of 15 and 19, boys commit suicide 4 times as often. Between the ages of 20 and 25, about 5 times as often. And so I started to see that with the increase in testosterone and boys learning that you can't express your feelings, you better, if you're going to be a real man, you don't cry, you keep them to yourself. Girls are not that attracted to boys that are whining and complaining. They fall in love not with whining boys, but with alpha men. And so if you want to be attractive to women, you just keep your feelings to yourself and you do what you think will make you attractive to women. And in the process, you build up a volcano of repressed feelings that, one day comes out in anger or physical abuse, or you just keep repressing them by drinking or taking opioids and dying of drug overdoses. Or you withdraw into video games and you become addicted to video games, or you realize that there's no women that are really interested in you because women don't date losers, they date winners. And so, they don't want to hear about men's complaints because, as I said, they don't fall in love with whining men, they fall in love with alpha men. So you see that there are very few girls really interested in you. So you go to the one place where you can have girls be attractive females, be connected with, and that's pornography. Because pornography is basically attraction to a large number, a large variety of attractive women without being rejected. at a price you could afford. And so boys tend to sort of get into that, and a little bit of pornography usually doesn't create many problems, but usually pornography, as you get into it, becomes more and more addictive. And so you start having a need for higher and higher amounts of stimulation. And before you know it, you have to, you're stimulated by the need to have women be doing really things with you sexually that the woman might not enjoy doing. And so when you finally get a real life woman over to your home, or someplace where you can go to bed with each other, the woman often feels like she's being treated like an object in a porn movie. And the reason is that the only thing the boy knows is what he sees in the porn movie. And she is being objectified as a porn object. And so she withdraws and feels, and that only proves to him that he's a loser who needs to go back to porn in order to have any stimulation from women. And so this, all of this, I saw more related to dad deprivation than any other single thing. And so as I started doing the research and writing on the boy crisis, I started seeing what there was that dads do that is different from what moms do that lead to both girls and boys who have a significant amount of dad involvement to be so much healthier mentally, physically, emotionally, and in terms of academic success and in terms of economic success on every single metric, boys and girls who had dad involvement did so much better. And so my next set of questions was, you know, what exactly did dad contribute that was complementary to what moms contribute that made children who had what I call checks and balance parenting between involved moms and involved dads do the best in every aspect of mental health, physical health, academic health, and economic success.
Dr. Farrell, one of the things during your talk there that I noticed and I wrote down right away is it seems to start during adolescence and puberty, this whole idea of harnessing emotions. I wouldn't say just aggression, but understanding emotions, mentorship and camaraderie. That seemed to be what I took away from that. As a kid that grew up with a dad in the household and grew up around strong male figures, I totally understand it. I was working construction at 12, 13 years old. I understood camaraderie amongst men. I learned how to talk like the other men I was surrounded by. I learned rejection quickly. I learned acceptance quickly. These are things that I see a lot of, you know, like I said, in our small town, a lot of the dads, you know, aren't necessarily in the picture a lot of the time because of this. And I think it has a lot to do with being uneducated on the topic mainly. So what would you say to the dads who are wondering if it's in their best interest to, you know, maybe take a job that might make a few dollars less, but they get to spend more time with their kids?
Yes, absolutely. Men, because we've been programmed basically to be a man by being willing to be disposable at work or being disposable in war. Every generation that had this war usually needed recruited men to come to that war. We, in the United States, we said, Uncle Sam needs you, Uncle Sam wants you, and men felt needed and wanted if they were willing to be disposable in war. And we learned to call that power. We got, you know, we saw pictures of our uncles on the mantle with, and dad said proudly that, you know, Uncle Joe died and he was a Marine and, we're really proud of him. And so boys started thinking of themselves, well, I'm always criticized, you know, by dad and by mom for not doing this or that. I'm mocked by kids at school, but if I become a Marine, I'll have respect and so on. So we learned to and the implications when we had children is when children came, we realized that maybe if we were doing something that we really love doing, maybe we're an artist, a writer, a musician, or an elementary school teacher, that, you know, musicians, usually they don't make very dependable income. Neither do artists, neither do writers. Hence you hear starving artists. And, you know, and most actors are called, you know, waiter. And so, you know, and when the children come, men learn like, well, now I don't have the option of being these sort of airy fairy type of things like an elementary school teacher. I love kids, but, you know, I better become either a principal, a superintendent, or start selling product X, or start working in a coal mine or on an oil rig, or doing something where I make real money. I don't have the luxury of not making real money now that I have children to support. And my wife is going to be taking time with the children, and that's going to take her away from her work. So we only have one source of income. That's me. And we have, you know, we have to make sure that we move into good neighborhoods with good school systems, so the kids have opportunities that I never had. And so that's the way we express love. And it's what I call the father's catch 22. We learn to love the family by being away from the love of our family. But what I discovered when I did the research for the boy crisis is that that mentality only works up to about a $50,000 to $70,000 worth of US money income per year. And once you go beyond that, the children benefit largely from dad's time rather than, as I mentioned before, rather than dad's dime. And so, the real core of this is understanding what exactly we do as dads that's different from what moms do, that make children who have significant amounts of dad's involvement grow up much more successfully in terms of mental health, physical health, economic health, academic achievement, mm-hmm. and long-term success and happiness. And here's just one, and I have a whole chapter in the boy crisis on some of these male, female, this dad, mom differences, but I'll just give you an example of one. The dads are oftentimes like much more likely than moms to roughhouse with the kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and say, you and moms are looking, ready to look on, and they go, oh my God, you know, I see that dads are getting ready to roughhouse. I feel like now I have only one more child to monitor here. And yeah. And she's thinking that, you know, on the other hand, I don't want to be controlling. The kids look like they're having fun. I'm going to try to trust dad to really, you know, not get too, you know, not too physical with the roughhousing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have this fear that, you know, somebody's going to get hurt sooner or later. Well, her fear is only 99.9% likely to be justified. Usually in the roughhousing, at some point in the process, somebody gets hurt. And then mom says to herself, now she feels guilty, mom does, feels like, oh my God, I should have intervened sooner. I sort of knew that was my intuition. Now one of the kids are crying. And I had a sense of that all along. I feel I wasn't responsible as a mom. And then she sees that dad is saying, okay, you know, you can't, you know, you can roughhouse, but you can't stick your elbow in your sister's eye, Jimmy. All right, dad, I got it. So then mom sees dad return to the roughhousing, and mom is going like, oh my God, now I really know I have only one more child to monitor. I thought he would learn by this mistake exactly what I predicted happened. But dad goes back to the roughhousing, and once again, one of the children is more aggressive than he should be, than she should be. And dad says, okay, I told you couldn't do this type of aggressive behavior. There'll be no more roughhousing until tomorrow night. So now mom is like, all right, he stopped the roughhousing, but what? He rescheduled it for tomorrow night? Doesn't he get it that it's roughhousing that's the problem? And so mom is really frustrated now, but again, trying to not be over controlling and interfering. And so the next night, the father repeats the warning, but this time the children, rather than ignoring the warning, they remembered that last time they were too aggressive, they lost the roughhousing. So now the kids are realizing that they don't, that it's different with dad than with mom. With mom, when they ignore her, she just repeats what she said before. And if I have to refrain from pushing my brother and sister aside from in order to win on the roughhousing, And the only thing I'm going to get in return is another warning. No problem. I'll just do what I want to do. But if I'm going to lose the roughhousing, that's what I'm here for. That's what's all the fun. Then I'm going to really pay attention to not being doing the thing that's going to lose the roughhousing. So what's happening there? The children with dad are learning postponed gratification. They want to push their brother and sister aside in order to win the roughhousing. But they now know that if they do that, they're going to lose the roughhousing because dad tends not just to set boundaries. Dads are more likely to both set and then enforce the boundaries they set. Moms are more likely to sort of repeat the boundary they set. And the children feel like there's not that much of a, you know, all right, mom's talking. That's, you know, she's just repeating it. If I go ahead and I do, you know, push my sister or brother aside again and are too aggressive, you know, I'll just get another warning and then another warning and then another warning. And usually I can get 5 or 6 warnings out of mom before she gets really angry and stops things. And when I, you know, share this with moms and dads, you know, in an audience maybe of 1,000 people, I see virtually every mom and every dad raising their, you know, head and going, yeah, we got that. The people that aren't shaking their heads like that are the kids that don't, are the people that don't have children. They think it'll be different for them.
I saw that growing up, you know, it was like mom would give us 5 or 6, you know, warnings. And then the second she said, wait till your dad gets home. And it was like, oh, we got to smarten up. But like, I remember growing up, I was like 10 or 11 and my dad took away Halloween from us and we just couldn't believe it. And I tell you what, we never, you know, disobeyed around holidays again because we were afraid that we would get it taken away. And I see that with my wife too. And it's kind of funny. My son, he's 2, he's sleeping in the room across from me here. And I see my mom specifically, look at me with almost disgust when I start roughhousing because I've kind of taught him how to wrestle back and forth a little bit. And, you know, seeing the rolling of the eyes and the sighing and the be careful. And it's amusing to me, but I completely understand it because I see my boys and there's something about telling them specifically what to do and setting that boundary where they understand it. One of the things that we talked about here at our house that actually you talked about in your book is we do the chores and the responsibilities before we get the reward. So instead of rewarding them with after the chores, we say, you can have this 100% as long as you get X, Y, and Z done. And, you know, those are some of the things that reinforce that, oh, maybe I am doing the right thing as a father. You know what I mean? So one of the things that I wanted to touch on though, before I know you got to get going. So with your research and talk about suicide rates having a direct correlation to fatherless homes amongst teens, I heard this being discussed a few years ago by Dr. Jordan Peterson, and after my own research and then reading your book, not only was this true, but these numbers are increasing as the years go on, and in our field of mental health, we're seeing that significantly in our small town. In the boy crisis, you go to great lengths discussing the options we as men have to prevent this and what we as society can do to help bring these numbers down. I guess my question is pretty simple, Dr. Farrell. How do you think our communities can fill the fatherless void with our children?
We really have to begin to share with each other how important dads are. And in order to do that, we have to know why they are so important. We have to see that, like in that roughhousing example, that there were so many things being learned there, that there was a that the children were learning when to be how to be assertive versus how to be aggressive, and that fine line between being assertive versus aggressive, and realizing that children that know that fine line, they're ones that have more friends at school. Children that have more friends at school are less likely to withdraw into video games and become addicted. They're more likely to have the social reinforcement of good friendships. They're more likely to have emotional skills, mental health skills. They're less likely to become depressed, less likely to commit suicide, less likely to become, and so father-involved children have so many benefits, but we can't blame this on moms. Moms can't hear what dads don't say. And we can't blame it on dads, because the reason I put so much of this in the Boy Crisis book was because as I examined parenting magazines and other parenting books, no one was talking about the positive contributions of dads. They were talking about it in general, but they weren't helping the dad understand that when he encourages the children to climb a tree and mom says, no, you shouldn't climb a tree, that most dads don't explain that when you climb a tree where there's some risk involved, your brain synapses start firing and becoming more elastic and your intelligence increases. When you are doing the roughhousing, your ability to discern what's assertive, what's aggressive, your ability to create postponed gratification if you have good boundaries that are enforced, these are all things that help you through life. If you don't have postponed gratification and you're desirous of, let's say your son is a tall person and he thinks he can become an NBA player he's really great at ice hockey. Well, he may try out for the ice hockey team, but if he doesn't have discipline, he's never going to make the team in any way that leads to a scholarship or leads to a professional opportunity. And so he's going to be, not only will he not make the team, but he's going to have a dream that he doesn't succeed at fulfilling that translates into him being disappointed in himself, ashamed of himself. He's telling other people, I'm really good, I'm gonna make the team. He's telling his mom and his dad. He's seeing his dad and mom and other people and girls. In the United States here, we have a lot, every school has football, and the football has the cheerleaders, and the cheerleaders, when the cheerleaders aren't saying, they're saying first and 10, do it again, which basically means first and 10, risk a concussion again. And ice hockey, you have the same type of incentive. And so it's very rare that the cheerleader says, I saw you cheering and I see you've lost your position on the team, but I want to continue cheering for you because you're I saw when you were on that football team, how carefully you listened, how loving you were, how compassionate you were. So I want to continue cheering for you. No, she doesn't do that. She continues cheering, but she cheers for his replaceable part. And every boy learns that, that girls are interested in guys, not who are Clark Kents, but who are Superman. And so the signals that that boys get from girls is that if I'm going to be attractive to girls, I have to be a winner. I have to have that discipline. I have to have that postponed gratification. And so that's part of what dads bring to the family table. But the problem is that most dads don't know what they bring to the family, and therefore they can't express it to women, and they can't even articulate it to themselves. Can you imagine a dad saying, I want to do more roughhousing with the kids because it really helps them have empathy? Well, we now know that the roughhousing by a dad does lead to children having empathy. Remember Jimmy not putting his elbow in his sister's eye? He learns that his sister, her needs need to be thought of, not just his needs to win the wrestling.
Right. And it goes back to your climbing the tree analogy, right? You're teaching them to take a risk. And, if you end up failing climbing the tree and falling, it's kind of like not making the team in sports. And you have to learn to live with that failure, but also think outside the box and how maybe we can climb the tree next time, or how do we make sure we don't fall? And so I like I said, your book has completely, I guess you could say, revolutionized the way I think about being a parent. And I've read it twice in the last 6 months. I had to read it a second time, especially the chapter on ADHD. My son has been recently diagnosed with ADHD, and it's helped a lot. It's helped a ton from the way we treat him, the way we, structure his routine, all the way to his diet. So personally, I thank you for coming on the show and writing your book and bringing such incredible knowledge to fatherhood. So I appreciate you taking the time to do this interview, Dr. Warren Farrell, and it's been an honor.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure for me too. And may I just say that I've been getting a lot of feedback that a lot of people, who men in particular, who read the Boy Crisis book, actually get as much out of it by listening to it on Audible, and especially if the man commutes or the woman commutes or works out in a gym. It really, and the voice, hearing my voice with the data tends to be very helpful for a number of people I'm hearing. So that's an option as well.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm going to stop the recording here, but I appreciate it, guys. Go check out The Boy Crisis. I can't really reach it right now, but you'll check out The Boy Crisis at www.warrenferrell.com. Is that correct? Warrenferrell.com? Yeah, perfect. All right, Dr. Warren Ferrell, thank you so much. I appreciate it.